Hi, everybody. This is John Reese of BluePower.com talking to Mr. Carl Verheyen today. Thank you for allowing us into your beautiful home.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for coming over.
Hey, I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time.
Great.
And, I mean, it was, what, last year that I saw you at the Baked Potato.
Yeah, the little Baked Potato.
At the behest of Mr. Bob Katz.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was completely floored. Completely amazed by what you did with a trio. I mean, the virtuosity in the playing and the difference in types of music that your ability takes you to was an amazing thing for me. I'm a big guy on choice of notes.
Mm-hmm.
I've been an engineer for a long time and engineered a lot of people that play all the instruments. And choice of notes has always been a big thing with me.
Right.
What to play and what not to play.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You've been playing since you were 10, correct?
Yeah, I actually got my first guitar at 11, on my 11th birthday.
Yeah.
But I was fooling around with friends' guitars before that. But on my 11th birthday, I got a guitar in the morning and later that afternoon a lesson.
Excellent.
So it was a great way to kick it off, you know.
Did you have a lesson from someone who you felt was a good
My parents found a guy named John Merrill, and he was in a band. This is 1965. He was in a band called the Peanut Butter Conspiracy.
And
one of those psychedelic bands. And I remember the coolest thing about this guy, besides the fact that lessons were $2.50.
Oh, my goodness.
The coolest thing about this guy, he had an upright piano in his bedroom. Lived with his parents, and there was an upright in his bedroom, and I went, man, this guy's cool, you know? And he used to reach over and show me some chords and, you know, how to play them and stuff like that on the guitar, and these are all the white notes, and it was very cool, a good start, you know?
A good basis.
Yeah.
And that's what you need, to learn the basics,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, you need that guy, you know, that keeps you interested, and when I said, can you teach me how to play Turn, Turn, Turn by the Birds or Mr. Tambourine Man or something like that, he knew it.
Yeah,
he could do it. So,
well, that's excellent.
Yeah.
What was your first guitar?
Oh man, it was a St. George nylon string guitar that was made, you know, in Japan, and it was $30.
$30.
Yeah.
wide neck.
Must have been a wide neck, and you know, high action. Who knew?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And there was no bending of notes on those things.
You have had an amazing career you started virtually, in the early 80s?
Yeah, my first record was like 1987, 88, right around there.
Yeah.
And I had been playing in the 70s. I had really immersed myself in jazz. I was just tunnel vision, wanted to learn 100, 150, 200 standards and mm-hmm. really learn how to play through changes. I was influenced by Wes Montgomery and George Benson and Pat Metheny and Pat Martino and Joe Pass and some of those guys. And I went down that long, dark jazz highway pretty hard and heavy, you know. But in the 80s, it hit me that, that's just one avenue of music that I enjoy listening to. I also like Chet Atkins and Leslie West, and you know, the list just goes on and on and on. And I started to just learn everything I dig.
Yeah.
And that got me in the early 80s kind of into the studio scene in LA.
Yeah.
And it opened up my mind to all the various styles. I took some classical guitar lessons and learned how to play, you know, a repertoire of that stuff. Revisited people that I knew when I was in high school, like Albert King and you know, some of that great music. And began to just play all styles. If you like it, you must learn it, was my motto. You know, if you dig it, you must learn it. I learned country music and bluegrass and, you know, just tried to dive into each style as my interest went down that road. You know, as I was interested, I would learn it.
You went to the Berklee School in Boston.
I was there for 3 months is all. You know, I probably should have stayed longer, but the overriding feeling at the time was that I needed to get out on the street and start playing. You know, I just really felt that what I need is experience playing. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I know some of the, I know most of this stuff they're showing me here, and the rest is logical, and you can get it off records. You can transcribe your vinyl and your CDs and pull it off there. So that was my feeling. I don't recommend that for everybody. I was just really motivated that way, you know, to get started playing gigs, you know.
Yeah. So. Yeah, you play some beautiful chords.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing. It's amazing what you can do with a guitar.
Yeah, you can really do a lot. I mean, the Stratocaster, the way I got, this is an old 58 right here. but I just love the sound of each one of these pickups. Now that's the neck position.
Yeah.
One. Then I get a much more mellow. That's
West
that pickup
Montgomery,
there.
I love that.
Then in the middle position, you know, I get more of a glassy sound. In this back pickup, I get more of a clucking. Sound, and then the very back, a nice Telecaster,
yeah,
kind of bright sound.
Yeah.
So there's a natural progression right through the pickups, and I just wire my Strats a little bit different. I make this knob here the tone knob for these two,
mm-hmm,
and Leo Fender had this for this pickup, and the back tone knob here for this pickup, and the very back pickup went straight out.
Yeah.
But I find the need to color that pickup a bit sometimes, you know,
yeah,
you know, just that's the one where you can get a lot of tonal variations out of actually. So I make this a master tone for these two and this tone for this back pickup.
Excellent.
And everybody puts the five-way switch in if it doesn't already have it, you know.
Yeah.
So
when did you learn to read?
You know, that's a good question, because I showed up in this LA studio scene not being a very good reader. And I got my reading together because I was actually taking these classical guitar lessons from a guy named Ron Freshman. And he would be like showing me this Bach stuff, and I'd be trading him rock and roll lessons. And one day I said to him, man, I wish I could read better. I really wish there was like a class at Valley College or, you know, some school where we could go and learn to read better. And he goes, why don't we start our own class? And so he and I decided that we would buy each $75 worth of music. You know,
mm-hmm,
we bought violin books, flute books, trumpet books, clarinet books, anything in the treble clef that was melodic. We didn't buy any exercise books, but we bought, each of us bought a stack of music, especially duets, that was about 2 feet tall, cost $75 each, and a metronome. And the requirements were you had to have a pot of coffee going. And I would go to his house Monday, and he'd come to my house Tuesday. And so 5 days a week, we'd do 2 hours of reading in the morning, starting at 9:30, because we weren't working enough yet to where we had to cancel,
yeah,
anything. Man, we read from 9:30 to 11:30 with maybe a 15-minute break, drank coffee, made the metronome go faster and faster. By the end of a month, we were reading. But we did it for about 6 months or so, and we got to be really pretty good readers. And I believe that, you know, when you can read music, it's a real privilege. I can open up the Bach sonatas and partitas for solo violin on a Sunday morning, and I can read those down, and it brings you like a lot of pleasure just hearing,
yeah,
that stuff that he thought of right there in, you know, whatever, 1633 or whatever. You know, he's just dashing the stuff off as he was making it,
yeah,
up. And that's a joy to just tap into the mind of Bach or somebody like that, you know.
So you suggest then that people should learn to read.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing to do. I think if you don't, you're missing the way all musicians are communicating.
Yeah.
As opposed to tablature on the guitar, which is, you know, the way guitar players who can't read communicate.
Yeah.
But that leaves out so much, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, reading is a good thing.
I'd like to ask you about your tours with Supertramp.
Oh yeah.
Those must have been interesting. I mean, you've,
yeah,
traveled the entire world.
Yeah. Great bunch of guys.
Man.
I miss those guys. I mean, they're kind of scattered out all around the country, and one guy lives in England. And,
mm-hmm,
and yeah, I joined the band in 85, and, you know, it was a whole new world for me, because I've been playing in places like the size of, I remember playing in the Studio Cafe down in Newport Beach, which holds like 120 people, right? And then the next gig was 20,000 people with Supertramp. So I went, something's different here.
Yeah.
But yeah, great bunch of guys, and really a first class experience, you know, all the way around. You know, they've done it for so long, they don't want to mess around.
They don't scrimp on anything.
No, nothing. Yeah.
Well, that's always a joy.
Yeah. And I actually enjoy the music. Before I joined the band, I wasn't a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I liked a few of the tunes, Goodbye Stranger and Give a Little Bit, and Take the Long Way Home, maybe stuff like that. But I didn't realize just how deep the catalog was. And another thing that's really interesting is you think of those guys as primarily this sort of based in English dance hall music, you mm-hmm. know, like Breakfast in America. You know, that's almost like English dance hall music, right? But on the other hand, the guys in the band, especially Rick Davies, who's the keyboard player, he's really, really deep into American blues and R&B and jazz. He knows Horace Silver. He knows Ray Charles. He knows, you know, a whole lot of this stuff. And it was a pleasure to find out that, man, they know more about our music than we do, you know. And they're really into it. Their record collections include the whole Blue Note catalog and everything like that. So,
well, see, cool. Now that's an amazing thing. I mean, you just really wouldn't think that. You'd think they were just rockers.
I mean, they still were really into Traffic and Jethro Tull and some of the music that was coming up right before them. Because I think of Supertramp as really getting rolling around 74 with Crime of the Century. And peaking kind of at the Breakfast in America, which was right around 1979, 80. You know?
Yeah.
And then from then on, I mean, they've had successful records and stuff like that, but that was sort of a huge high point for them. And but there's a lot of music that's really soulful, you know, which is cool.
Who have you played with that you would say you learned the most from?
Well, definitely Rick Davies. That guy I learned a lot from, just in terms of putting on a show, you know, and how the show that you present to people, you know, in a concert situation, it needs to be as good as it can be. I mean, in other words, just because you're playing in, you know, Fredericton, New Brunswick, doesn't mean you don't give them the same show you give in New York City.
Exactly.
You know, and I really like that attitude, that show concept. The standards, you know, the quality level has to remain as high as possible. But I mean, let's see, who have I played with that I've learned from? I mean, there's so many guys, you know. One time I subbed for Larry Carlton on a gig with his wife, who's a contemporary Christian singer. Mm-hmm. And for the rehearsal, he said, just come over to the house, I'll show you what I played on the record. And I was a, you know, young, aspiring guitar player, and he showed me so many great rhythm guitar inventive ideas. I got a lot from that. But, I mean, we could go on and on and on about this. I mean, guitar players and keyboard players and drummers. I mean, just recently I played a few shows with Chad Wackerman. And I'm on his second album. Let's see, I co-wrote the title tune with him on his first album and then did the same on his second. And I've got an insane cat.
Siamese?
No, just an old geezer, you know.
Okay.
Old diabetic
Love
geezer.
Him.
Yeah. So he goes nuts every once in a while. But, you know, Chad is one of the most fearless drummers I've ever met. You know, he just goes for it and this is it. Bam! Lays it down. And I really, that fearlessness stuff, I think he learned from Frank Zappa. And over the years, I've kind of tried to emulate that idea, especially playing live, you know, just going for it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you are certainly amazing to watch live. And the types of music that you cover in a 45-minute set completely blew my wife and myself away.
Oh, great. Well, that's really cool.
And I was very pleased because I always liked your records.
Oh, yeah, I appreciate that. That's you reviewed one of them a long time ago.
In Cat for Cash Box.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, that was 90, I think, 95.
It might have been Slang Justice. That
was, the blues, more kind of blues-oriented.
Yeah, that was a little more bluesy. And
Yeah,
I think I had a few blues on there, one that went... And then there was a couple little funky things. But yeah, that was a bluesier record, that's true.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when I play live, I sort of returned to that blues rock thing. I think under the banner of blues rock, you can get away with murder, you know.
Yeah.
You can do all kinds of stuff, so.
Well, you're from Southern California,
mm-hmm.
right?
I was raised in Pasadena.
There are some wonderful guitar players from Southern California.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Fertile grounds around here.
Yes, it is. So. And, let me see. About television, mm-hmm. how do you like working television?
Well, in the days like, you know, the 80s and 90s, it used to be that there would be a lot more orchestral TV and there would be a lot more recording sessions. For instance, I did 8 years of Cheers, and we would have a session just about every week for Cheers, even though there was only 3.5 minutes of music. And I would have the full cartage rig and, you know, 24 guitars delivered. And, you know, the session would last a half an hour, but it was a recording session and with a downbeat at 10 o'clock. And then pretty soon the technology advanced to where people could do that same type of thing in their garage,
yeah,
or their bedroom, you know. So that kind of work really went away. You know, I watched it slipping away. I was still on a lot of TV, but it wasn't the full-on session with cartage, moving your gear and everything. It was, hey, can you come over and bring your 12-string and a Les Paul and a little amp, and we'll do it, you know. And so shows like Saved by the Bell, I remember doing all those in a guy's garage, and then pretty soon Seinfeld and all those shows came along where it was just factory, just slammed out that way. And I don't have a problem with that. I mean, it is background, under dialogue, incidental music. But it's no big deal anymore, you know. It's not it used to be kind of a big deal. They would have, you know, 28 guys assembled. And they still do for certain shows. The Simpsons is that way. And I believe there's sessions on Lost and a couple other, you know, a few other TV shows.
Some big ones.
Yeah, big ones still do it. So, and I think reality TV doesn't need any of that stuff. That's just library music for the most part, you know. So,
I didn't know you did worked on The Interpreter. I love that.
You mean the Negotiator?
The Negotiator.
I did some work in that, and if I'm not mistaken, I've got a tune in that movie.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, a tune I co-wrote with a guy. So that's a good movie, isn't it?
It's an excellent movie. And I want to ask you what you think about, and this is a sore topic for a lot of people, but what do you think about the RIAA and what the record companies are doing to webcasters these days?
Yeah, I'm not really up to date on it as far as I could, as much as I could be, but they're trying to in some way shut it down or license it?
They're trying to license it, but what they're trying to do is they're trying to make, well, not only webcasters, but terrestrial radio pay every time they play a record.
Yeah.
Which is odd to me because I was a record promotion man in my very young years in this business.
Wow.
And I remember them saying, do whatever you can do. This is the record companies, of course. Warner Brothers, Mercury, I work for Roulette. Yeah. Get these records played no matter what you have to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
Now they want radio to pay to play them.
Yeah.
Friends of mine at a number one station in LA said they will go talk first.
That's a big mistake.
It's a silly mistake.
Yeah.
And webcasters are the new radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I do.
We've got some XM radio in one of our cars, and man, that is such a pleasure.
Yeah.
You know, there's
no commercials.
Yeah. If you want to listen to Willie Nelson's picks, you know, you can check out country radio and blues. There's, you know, lots of jazz stations and lots of rock and roll. And sometimes I feel like listening to French world music or Latin music or whatever. I got it. You know, it's really something.
The world is out there.
Yeah. You know, the satellite deal is insane. So, anyway. Yeah, boy, I think they're making a big mistake, you know, if they try to do that, you know. But the record companies are going to have to refigure what they're going to do. You know,
CDs are down 62%.
Yeah.
Insane.
It's amazing. 62.
Jerry Del Colliano, who was a guy who wrote a newsletter for radio for years and years, now teaches a class over at USC. And he did a poll of his students and asked them, said, how many CDs have you bought in the last year? Well, 50% of them said none.
Zero, yeah.
Because they get them for free.
Yeah, they do. I think they've got to refigure how they're going to sell music because I don't think that's going to continue. There'll always be the collectors.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a guy that I'll download it if I don't really care about it. I pay for it because I don't want to see the artist not...
Yeah.
I want to vote for the artist in any capacity I can, whether it's paying a 99-cent iTunes thing or whatever. But if I really want the music, I want to buy the CD because it sounds so much better, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm a collector in that sense, you know. I mean, I still have my vinyl. So, in the vinyl. So,
what's next for you?
Well, let's see. I need to make another record pretty soon. And I've been thinking, I've got two choices. I can do another record of the original stuff I do. But the band, we have a certain second set thing going on to where the first set is, if we do a two-set night, the first set is a big show, right?
Mm-hmm.
The second set is kind of more having fun. And in the course of that, I've probably got 20 different cover tunes I do, you know, from a ska version of, you know, this tune to a blues version of a John Fogerty tune. You know, it can be any old thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those things have sort of developed. And in the course of doing that, I'm thinking, you know, some of this, people are asking me, when are you going to put that that version of 6 Days on the Road on a record? You know? So that might be something I have to do next, just all cover tunes.
I think it'd be a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it'd be a really fun thing to do. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, you know, when and where. I've got a tour coming up in May that I'll be out for about 5 weeks. Starts in Rome and ends in the Canary Islands.
Oh, my goodness.
That's going to be interesting.
That'll be fun.
So, yeah, it'd be a great tour.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So what would you have to say, this is a question I always ask, any young guitar enthusiast that wants to learn, what, any sage words of wisdom?
Well, there's the casual hobbyist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a guy who wants to make a living. Now, if you want to make a living, I think the first thing you got to consider is that if you are a heavy metal guitarist, you get this big of the pie,
mm-hmm.
this little slice of the pie. But if you can play rockabilly and bluegrass and country and regular heavy metal and jazz and Dixieland, and then we just go around the pie naming all the styles, blues and rock.
Yeah.
And once you sort of get a handle of what I call the ornamentation of the style, and I mean, I can really easily demonstrate it if I'm thinking in terms of a blues and, you know, jazz blues. Certain ornamentation. It's the Mixolydian mode, a few little diminished licks and, you know, crazy scales thrown in there, but there's an ornamentation to that sort of bebop type style. Now, same key, G7th, you know, country music. That's the same scales and stuff, but the ornamentation changes. I'm putting the flat third next to the natural third, you know.
Yeah.
Now, if I was, I've got no distortion pedal hook up to this, so I can't really demonstrate like metal or anything like that. But there's an ornamentation to each style.
Yeah.
You know, and the ornamentations, you start to say, well, the country guys are more into the bending thing, and the bluegrass guys are more the open string thing. You know?
Yeah.
So you start putting those things, associations together, and, you know, now if I was playing a straight blues, you know, the vibrato is really important. And recently I've thought about, you know, in doing some guitar clinics and workshops, I've thought about the artistic signatures of everybody that influenced me chronologically from, you know, when I was just starting out. So it starts with people like George Harrison and Roger McGuinn, and then moves into Clapton. And I can actually play, you know, an example of each one of these like 25, 30 players.
Wow.
And say, here's what I got from them. Just because I've been thinking about it lately, you know. And with Mike Bloomfield, for instance, it's that vibrato and that sort of slinky, mm-hmm. slidey kind of playing he did. With Pat Martino, you know, he's got more of a...
Ah.
You know, just that attack of every note having the same duration.
Yeah.
You know, and you can go through all the players. You know, Pat Metheny, and recently I've been into Derek Trucks, the slide guy.
Oh, yeah.
I've been trying to learn Derek Trucks' licks on the guitar without the slide. Just to kind of like that expression that he gets out of the great slide playing. You know, just that's what I'm practicing, that kind of stuff.
So just learn as much as you can.
Yeah, basically. I think styles are really important. Even if you're only interested in one style, I think it's important to, you know, just try to, because everything you do, like if I learn a Chet Atkins,
thank you.
piece like that,
yeah,
you know, that's helping all this right hand stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, and enable me to. Everything helps everything else,
yeah.
You know. I
yeah.
think that, and that goes for careers too.
Yeah.
You know, the gig I've, the being a member of Supertramp has helped my solo career and helped my studio career. And my studio career and knowing how to get sounds into the studio has definitely helped my solo career.
Yeah.
Know? And I mean everything. And the solo career can be, you know, quite all encompassing.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot you can do with that.
You've been doing a lot solo lately, I've noticed.
Yeah, I've been trying to tour, you know, about 4 months a year.
Yeah.
That's about right for me, so.
And you play just yourself.
Yeah.
No other musicians, completely solo.
I can do that, too, and I have a little circuit. I do an acoustic tour.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, do I ever have to practice up for that.
You know, really?
It takes a lot of... That takes like 2 weeks of intense practicing on the acoustic guitar before I'm ready to do the first show.
Yeah.
And then I suck. And the second show is like it comes to the party, you know, it's like getting there. So
I love an honest man. I love
that
an
first show
man.
Though is always a little tough.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh man, I've had a great time. Thank
and
you.
Would you do us a favor? Would you play us a small piece?
Sure.
To take it out, one of yours perhaps.
Oh, one of mine. Let's see what I can do on this guitar here. Here's one called Henry's Farm.
Excellent.
Piece, but it works.
Carvajal, thank you so much.
Thank you, John,
for coming on Blue Power and taking the time to allow us to come up here and wake you up early in the morning and make you do difficult stuff like that.
All right, next time I'll warm up.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great.